Where were you? What are the memories that linger? What are the images you can't erase? That pretty well sums up what many of us have felt about the several crises that have occurred. Immediately after the collapse of the mission, I called Arnold Frutkin because I knew he would have sound ideas and a vast amount of information about the subject. He grew up in what we used to call the Westchester area, New Rochelle and Mount Vernon. He, in 1940, earned his BA degree at Harvard. He went on in 1942-45 to serve in the South Pacific as a naval officer, and is now retired in the Naval Reserve as a commander. He had a period of experience in commercial publishing, the Bureau of National Affairs, as managing editor and board member for that publication for a period of 12 years. And then at the time of the International Geophysical Year, he was deputy executive director of the U.S. National Program for the International Geophysical Year. He virtually at the beginning of NASA, from 1957 until 1979, served for 20 years in NASA and rose to the position of Associate Administrator of External Affairs, having been an administrator earlier of International Affairs for NASA. He had several international marketing positions with Unisys and others, vice president of these companies. And he won the NASA Distinguished Service Medal twice, NASA Exceptional Service Medal, National Civil Service Award, Naval Unit Citation from several countries. So, this is a career that stands out by any comparison, and we're proud of the fact that some of our own members represent resources that never ought to be overlooked, and that really are an indispensable source of knowledge and information, addition of information for all of us. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce Arnold Frutkin, who will talk with us this morning about the whole crisis and sum up some of the problems for the future, the important problems that sometimes in our sorrow for what happens are not immediately thought of, but are with us for the indefinite future. So it's a great pleasure.
Thank you, Ken. I thought as I came up the driveway this morning and saw all the cars to ask Nan who was speaking this morning. I take it as a considerable interest in the shuttle itself. Some time ago, Ken wrote me a note asking me if I knew of anyone who might speak objectively about the shuttle. And I wrote him back that I knew of no one who was objective about the shuttle. People I knew in the aerospace industry and since were either strongly for it or strongly against manned flight, generally speaking. And I suggested in my note some things he might bear in mind when he looked for someone. That was my mistake. He came back and he said, just use paragraphs 2, 3, and 4 of your note and give a talk here. And you cannot say no to Ken Thompson. So with that, let me proceed to these notes. People generally share a certain amount of knowledge and concern with the two failures of the shuttle, the Challenger and the Columbia. But bear in mind that the shuttle has had about 110 successful flights and 25 years of operation. Those successful flights have had a good deal less attention and are not really too well understood, according to my lights. The safety issue, which of course arises with Columbia and Challenger, is under investigation by a competent board, and results are starting to come in. To a certain extent, they're prejudged. One can sense that the fundamental decision, continuing with manned flight, has been made, and that the shuttle will continue whatever it takes. That at least is the sentiment expressed by the administration. I propose to look at the shuttle's more routine performance in space, leaving the safety issue to that competent board. Particularly, I want to look at how the shuttle's performance compares with its advance billing in the first place 25 years ago. When we do that, I think we will find a number of questions pop up, and they're important questions apart from safety. They'll tell us what the shuttle is and what it is not, how useful it is, what purpose it is serving, and what implications in particular this has for future manned flight. Then, just to bring this presentation safely within the ambit of the Miller Center, I'll try to say a thing or two about the decision-making process. Let's start with the origins of the shuttle. The shuttle grew out of a search for a follow-on program to the Apollo lunar landing program. You will know, of course, that a tremendous industrial bureaucratic base had been built for that program. I think at the time NASA had perhaps 90,000 people. The contractor base probably was greater. But expenditures for a program like Apollo follow something like a bell curve. They build up as you go into the hardware phase, and then they taper off and as you go into operations. So the congressional committees, which were responsible for supporting the program, began to look to NASA for a follow-on program, one that would maintain continuity in that level of expenditures and keep that base, industrial base and bureaucratic base, going. It was a rather amusing situation because the administrator at the time, Jim Webb, was an old congressional staffer and thought he had learned a lesson that you never put out proposals, because all you do is become a target for criticism and rival notions. And so he said, "No proposal from me, I want a public debate." This is an interesting decision-making process. In the vacuum, the manned flight people at NASA who were engaged in the lunar landing program simply moved in and began to talk of a very ambitious program involving the development of a shuttle which could ascend to space, help construct a space station, and that in turn would, in the long run, become a staging base for manned flights to Mars. It was a neat package. In the middle of the discussions, which began, as I say, as Apollo expenditures were tapering off, the lunar landings were successfully achieved, and that contributed a tremendous amount of euphoria and confidence to the whole discussion of manned flight programs. When the first proposal for a shuttle, the first of these three items, reached the Congress, no one looked too hard at the content of the program. There was tremendous confidence in NASA, every assurance that this new program would be as successful as the Apollo program, and it went ahead without significant examination. The new NASA administrator, euphoric beyond belief, spoke happily at the time of a 100-man space station. In fact, when we went abroad to try to convince the Europeans to participate in the program, we sat Tom down and said, "Tom, you must not mention 100-man space stations during this trip because we'll lose all credibility." And he agreed. Nixon, in the end, authorized only the shuttle. And it's part of my comment on the decision-making process that that authorization, as in most of these large space programs, was more a ratification than an authorization. Advanced studies and even early development had already begun by the time Nixon fixed his signature to an approval. And we were well along in discussions with the Europeans on their contribution, which was to be the space laboratory carried up in the shuttle. The Europeans spent $1 billion for that. And because I didn't believe in soft bargains with other countries, we owned it. Now, the shuttle was marketed on the basis of a package of rationales. First was cost effectiveness. Everyone was very conscious of the high cost of space activity, and a key element in the shuttle proposal was that the shuttle was to be reusable as a way of achieving economies. Until that time, all space activity was performed with the help of expendable launch vehicles, Castaway. So it seemed obvious that a reusable shuttle would be far less costly than a throwaway launcher. In addition, the low cost of launches would attract everybody who wanted to launch scientific applications and commercial and military satellites. The shuttle would have all that business, and that would assist in bringing the cost further down. Shuttle crews would be able to visit ailing satellites and repair them. If it wasn't easy to repair them in space, the shuttle could permit you to retrieve satellites already in orbit, which were not functioning properly, bring them back to the Earth for repair, and launch them again. More savings. The vehicle that was designed was technologically far more demanding than the Apollo lunar landing. The Apollo was built largely with available technology. The shuttle developed new technology. Reusable engines had never been achieved before. Engines operating with the internal stresses of these engines were unheard of. They were to be, in order to achieve the reusability, they would have to be reusable without significant overhaul for extended periods of time. And then there would be the, the entirely new system for heat insulation for reentry, the tiles. Now, the shuttle was not approved without controversy. I mean, the Congress made no significant inquiry, but even within NASA, there were very serious doubts about the shuttle. And unfortunately for the decision-making process, those doubts were a matter of corridor discussion, as in any large organization, rather than organized presentations to the powers that were to make decisions. Still, very informed and perceptive commentary on the shuttle's possible future problems emerged publicly. And I'm going to give you an example, one example. An article written 23 years ago by Greg Easterbrook, one of the people I recommended to Ken speak here instead of me. This article was published in 1980 in the Washington Monthly and recently again in the Washington Post after the Columbia loss. Easterbrook pointed his piece in 1980 at the long delays in getting the shuttle off the ground, hefty cost overruns, and in particular, he thought, shortfalls in performance. He argued that the shuttle would have a lack of work to do when it was launched. And here are some of his remarks, and I'm going to quote. "The main cause of delay is currently the shuttle's refractory tiles. Columbia must be fitted out with 33,000 of these tiles, each to be applied individually, each unique in shape. They're so fragile you can hardly touch them without shattering them. There is no backup for them. If they fail, the shuttle burns on reentry. If enough fall off, the shuttle may become unstable during landing and thus unpilotable. The worry runs deep enough that NASA investigated installing a crane assembly in Columbia so the crew could inspect and repair damaged tiles in space. Verdict, can't be done." Now, Easterbrook did note that subsequent shuttles would have improved tiles. But here's another quotation from his article in 1980. "Cost projections assumed that the shuttle fleet would stage at least 50 flights a year. 50 flights a year for what? It was assumed that there would be 20 flights a year for the space lab component. I can't imagine what for, says Albert Cameron, a Harvard physicist who is chairman of the Space Science Board of the National Academy of Sciences. The duration of the flight is so short, he explained, pointing out that it will ordinarily last only 4 to 7 days. There's way too little time to carry out any meaningful experiments." Another quotation. "Also in the calculation are 6 flights a year to launch communication satellites. How many communication satellites are now being launched? 2 a year. 75% of the shuttle program cost savings are based on assumptions about how much we will benefit from recovering crippled satellites. But more than 2/3 of satellites are sent to geosynchronous orbits, 22,000 miles up. The shuttle, on the other hand, orbits at 200 miles. Now, here Easterbrook explained that NASA wanted a tug, an additional space vehicle, that would ride up in the shuttle and be used to go up to greater heights to retrieve satellites that the shuttle itself couldn't reach. But the proposal for the tug was killed each year that NASA put it forward. "A communication satellite has absolutely no salvage values," says Larry Weekly, spokesman for a consortium of major companies putting up communication satellites. "It's much cheaper to build a new one." And of course, the obsolescence rate was such that after 7 or 10 years, you would want a new satellite, not refurbish the old one. "NASA has been casting about for other reasons to stage shuttle flights. The agency hoped that companies would sign up for space manufacturing tests. the search for the fabled flawless ball bearing. But so far, only one American firm has shown any interest, and NASA has promised to foot the full cost. The price per flight keeps climbing as the number of plausible missions decreases. Suddenly, the total cost of a shuttle flight becomes almost twice the cost of three of those wasteful, reusable rockets. Oh, the shuttle will definitely cost more than equivalent expendable rockets, said a spokesman plainly. I've not named the spokesman because he was a good friend of mine. The payoff is not in dollars, but in flexibility and expanded horizons. Easterbrook, that's the end of my quotes from Easterbrook. Easterbrook was optimistic that engine and tile problems would be fixed, but he took a dim view of the limited escape possibilities from the shuttle and the heavy dependence of the Defense Department on the shuttle. Finally, he said, but the question never answered is, what will the shuttle do that rockets couldn't do, expendable rockets couldn't do? So even before the first shuttle flew, Easterbrook was questioning the savings, the frequency of flight, the retrieval and repair functions, and the commercial uses of the shuttle, as well as its safety and escape prospects. That was before it ever flew. And bear in mind that everything he wrote about had to come from sources within NASA or from its contractors. So there was a certain lack of faith within the organizations working on the shuttle. Now, how, in fact, has the shuttle performed in these 23 years, and how accurate was Easterbrook's perceptions? The shuttle has been reusable, but only about four times a year, not 50 and not 20. Retrieval of failed satellites, no meaningful retrieval economies materialized for the shuttle. It simply couldn't reach the majority of satellites. There was not the interest in retrieving them. It was done on a couple of occasions, but I believe more for demonstration purposes than for practical economies. In-flight launches of satellites. The shuttle had this huge weight and volume capacity, so it could indeed serve as a platform for launching scientific, commercial, and military satellites. But unfortunately, the greatly increased costs, exceeding the cost of expendable launch vehicles, and then the Challenger disaster and the two-year delay that followed from that, all that combined to discourage the users, and they migrated back to expendable launchers. The military dropped out completely. So the goal of in-flight launches was not met either. Today, three out of four satellite launches are committed primarily to ferrying men, equipment, and material to the International Space Station, which was not on the books when the shuttle was approved. The shuttle was also supposed to do a permit onboard science, carries a space lab. A recent NASA review of the use of the space lab said 800 investigations were performed over 17 years in 36 flights of the laboratory. This averages out to about 22 experiments per flight, which is a big handful for a small crew, and it certainly establishes quantity. What of the quality of those investigations? The program's director claimed that there were major contributions to advancing knowledge, but he cited only a single example, which was new knowledge about soot. I was brought up to say soot formation in combustion. And that's important, especially for manned flight, where fire and combustion are significant problems. But you wonder why additional major results were not cited. And by the way, I had hoped very much to be able to report to you some of John Glenn's results on the aging process. I knew they'd be of great interest to this audience, but I'm unable to do that because there are no such results available. The only thing I could find is, from within NASA, a statement that additional experiments of the same kind will have to be done with other subjects in order to establish a benchmark. But we weren't told that by John Glenn before he flew this last time. In any case, the entire onboard science program has been severely impacted by sharp funding cutbacks caused by shuttle overruns and reduced availability of flights. Funds have been transferred from the science program to help the shuttle program limp along. Now, commercial processes, it is possible to do any number of commercial things in space, but there's small evidence that anyone ever bothered to validate the promises of commercial applications against cost, demand, price, volume, market, alternative methods, and the like. No one ever looked at those things. And to amuse myself, I calculated that if there were gold bricks floating around in near-Earth orbit, and you sent the shuttle up to recover 60,000 pounds of gold bricks, which is its capacity, and brought them back to Earth, you would lose only $480 million on the exercise because the shuttle launch costs $500 million and the $20 million or so that you'd realize from the gold bricks would simply not do the job. Now, there are people willing to use the shuttle for commercial advertising. There's a lot of that. And that raises a policy question for NASA and the administration. The Columbia was to carry two flowers, a miniature rose and an Asian rice plant, quote, in the hopes, I'm quoting a journalist here, in the hopes that the low gravity on the ship would morph their scents into something unusual that could be used in perfumes, soaps, and other consumer products. NASA paved the way for that, for most of that experiment. Now, Easterbrook did not mention space exploration as a justification for manned space activity. And certainly no environment, the New World, darkest Africa, the heights of the Himalayas, the Antarctic, has so captured the imagination as space exploration. So even if I thought the shuttle had little to do with space exploration, you'd understand I'd be reluctant to impugn an icon. But happily, NASA's chief scientist for Mars exploration and a former astronaut scientist, the one Jeffrey Hoffman who rode up into space with Kathy Thornton. I don't know if Kathy's here, but in any case, he and the current NASA administrator have all come to my rescue. It is apparently correct now to say that the shuttle has nothing to do with space exploration because it's confined to low Earth orbit. It's the distance from, less than the distance from Charlottesville to New York. That's how high the shuttle goes. The Apollo certainly contributed to space exploration with the landings on the moon, but since then, nothing has. And I think that this statement from these people is now just part of the argument that we should begin to do space exploration again by sending men to Mars. So there's a reason for pointing out that the shuttle is not engaged in space exploration. That That's a claim that has been made over and over again in the past. You remember Easterbrook said that the shuttle would have a lack of work to do, and I have tried to point out that the record suggests it's had a very marked lack of work to do. And the point has, in fact, been admitted. In 1993, Clinton's budget director, Leon Panetta, told the NASA administrator at the time that the space station was likely to be canceled. The space station, not the shuttle. Golden replied that, quote, without the space station, there would be no need for the space shuttle program, close quote. The shuttle's utility since that remark in 1993 has declined, if anything, against the original rationale, since three of the four launches have been committed to construction of the space station. So for policy purposes, there's a huge gap between the shuttle's marketing objectives and what it has delivered. If a journalist like Easterbrook could look so clearly into the prospects of the shuttle program, why was there so little official curiosity into the solidity of the claims being made for the shuttle in the beginning or since? Why the reluctance to question selling points or to ask for independent analysis of programs in this field before simply sliding into them? Now, I've made a point of this because we have the space station already under construction in space, and the shuttle and its continuity turn entirely on serving that next objective in space. President Reagan signed off on the space station with little more question or examination than the shuttle received. And the project limped along until it survived by one vote in the Congress in 1993, and then the Clinton administration got the brilliant inspiration that if they brought the Russians into the program, it would have a political justification that might carry it through. And indeed, the next vote passed by 100 votes instead of one. And by the way, we were paying for the Russian cooperation in the space station. Now, putting all that aside and recognizing that it's now a political question as much as it is a technical question, still you might want to ask some of the same questions that were asked about the shuttle 25 years ago by Easterbrook. How real are the long-term cost projections? So far, the cost of the shuttle has almost doubled. What non-subsidized commercial interests are really in prospect? None have come forward of any substance. Does the scientific community have any real interest in it? Yes, there are people interested. But I quote the National Research Council. These factors, and they're talking of the time available, the limitations of the crew. There are only three people in the space station. Because George W. Bush canceled a seven-man escape project. So that limits the crew of this enormous space station to three. And the three must spend 2.5 man periods on maintenance, leaving only half, really 15%, for science. The National Research Council says these factors, when combined with the poor track record of NASA and the International Space Station in meeting schedule, budget, and scientific performance targets, further detract from the ability of the International Space Station to garner the support of the scientific community. The uncertainty and instability in the space station program are disincentives to participation by both established and next-generation scientists whose careers can be seriously damaged by the failure of the station program to provide the promised scientific opportunities. Now, I was going to here get into a new concern raised to a new higher level about the medical effects upon astronauts of long-duration flight, but I see time is running along, and I'll save that for any questions you may have. I do want to make three points before concluding. First, when the Hubble telescope was first proposed, there were very aggressive efforts by what I must call the manned space flight community to provide that the Hubble telescope would be a manned astronomical observatory. And the astronomers, for the most part, fought that bitterly. I was there at the time. You've no idea how bitter that fight was. It ended when it was discovered that the mere presence of a man in the satellite, his breathing, his movements, would cause jitter and motion that would destroy the precision seeing for which the Hubble telescope was designed. And so the threat of manned presence in the Hubble telescope was dropped. And the Hubble telescope went along unmanned to be one of the most significant scientific projects we've had in space. Second, Kathy Thornton, who was afraid to come here today probably, and Jeffrey Hoffman, did this incredible, magnificent, courageous, and skillful exercise of walking out from the shuttle to repair the Hubble telescope. No one can detract from that. Yet it has to be said that the Hubble telescope and every other satellite can be designed on a modular basis so that a robot can go up there and change out a defective module, replace it at much less cost and no human risk. Third, and this is to me an extraordinary point, but you may or may not agree, in no discussion of future manned flight do I find any mention of a particular Soviet mission to the moon in the late 1960s. After we had landed on the moon and brought back pictures and rocks, the Russians landed an unmanned mission on the moon. It made a soft landing, in other words, a controlled landing. It deployed a mechanism which gathered in rocks from the surface, pulled them into a container, sealed the container, because in those days, people were afraid of reverse contamination back to the Earth. So it was sealed in there. And then this unmanned rocket took off from the moon and flew back to the Soviet Union and delivered its rocks safely. I saw those rocks in Moscow. And we negotiated an exchange program. We gave them some of our rocks, and they gave us some of their rocks. I think it's extraordinary that this rather remarkable unmanned robotic mission is never mentioned in connection with questions about manned flight. And I leave that with you. See how I can end this without taking much more time. I'm urging that manned flight be the subject of questioning and continued questioning. I'm sorry I couldn't get into the exposures, the medical cost of exposures to long-term flight, which involve bone loss, which it is not clear is ever replaced, and if replaced, according to one of those studies, the deterioration of the bone structure.
Bone density.
But yes, bone density, but it's what we older people get when we bend over. Thank you. Studies of osteoporosis. Not to say Alzheimer's, but studies of osteoporosis show that the bone loss is often replaced elsewhere, not where you lost the density. Well, with all that, I'm saying that questions should be continued. And they should be continued in the light not only of the problems we've had and the shortfalls of the shuttle and the risks of manned flight, but the extremes to which manned flight is now driving us. It is recently surfaced that the people at NASA are dismayed at the 9 months it would take to send a man to Mars and the 9 months back and some stay time on Mars that would justify the 18 months to get there and back. So let's assume a couple of months, 20 months of exposure to radiation, bone loss, and they don't mention micrometeorite collisions, but they're possible. With all those problems, isn't there room for extended robotic programs to see how far we can get with those, determine whether the objectives of putting a man in person on the surface of Mars would be worth the candle. The question of urgency is relevant. Why would we be in a hurry to go ahead with manned flight to Mars rather than go through an orderly, prudent, progressive, step-by-step program with robots to find out whether it's worth doing? I'm not arguing that man's desire for adventure, excitement, danger, and new frontiers should be questioned. You can't argue that. That's a given. You think that's important or you don't think it's important. It's there. But the question is, should the government pay for those who wish to indulge their desire for adventure? Now, decision making. I think I won't explain this because it takes time from your questions, but I think Eisenhower was the last president to define an overall national space strategy and follow it. And we can go into that if anyone's interested. Since then, we've been maintaining our level of expenditure and growing it. And I want to leave you with a last, very unfair story that might illustrate the level of consideration and judgment that appears to go into space decisions. I'm going to tell you that story even though it's unfair and even though it reveals that I sometimes watch Larry King. Larry King just recently interviewed William Jefferson Clinton after the Columbia tragedy, and they discussed the tragedy. And then King asked Clinton, what should be next on the space agenda? Clinton replied, I think we should look at the black holes. King stared for a moment, then he observed, well, that would be unmanned, wouldn't it? Clinton did not hesitate. No, he said, I think men have to do it. Now, I'm saying that there are some questions that need to be asked and answered. Now, if any of you don't know why this story is so funny, don't feel badly. You're not required to know what black holes are. But on the other hand, if you're the president and NASA reports directly to you, you ought to know what the black holes are. Thank you.
Is there anyone who would like to speak for the victim?
I'd like to ask if you think that the Air Force success with unmanned vehicles, aerial vehicles, plus Boeing's design for an unmanned fighter aircraft, which is on the drawing boards now, will that lend some impetus to NASA toward the robotic unmanned exploration that you're speaking of?
Well, it's a good question because it's rational, and therefore I'm not sure it will get much consideration. No, that's a very good question. There is an interesting new attention being given within NASA and by other space interests in robotic systems. But I think it is due to recognition that robotics are so impressive now that you have to take them into account. So, for example, Jeffrey Hoffman, who is a very able and competent scientist astronaut, was invited to give the Darwin lecture at Cambridge this year, says in that lecture that robotics must play a very significant role in future exploration, but in partnership with men. And I don't know how you balance that out. These things can be done unmanned. But the Air Force and NASA have a claque who are interested in a reusable space plane. And some progress has been made in those directions. It's a place where you could put an awful lot of money, and success would be a long way off. But hopefully those robotic successes will have some impact. I would hope they do.
Next question. Yes.
The issue of what could have been learned from the shuttle program includes the question of what we could have learned about human biology. And one of the problems has been that the astronaut corps as a group have been unwilling to serve as subjects for medical investigation in space. They have rather resisted it. In fact, they've been known to conceal illness from the flight surgeons in order to not to lose their position in the queue. The result is that there is a very limited amount of information available from 100 plus flights on that is relevant to understanding the needs for flight beyond Earth orbit. I had the privilege of coordinating a volume that the IOM put out a year and a half ago. The osteoporosis issue is so severe it amounts to 1% of your skeleton gone per month. Now, you add up a 20-month mission to Mars and return. That's 20% of your skeleton. I mean, that's far beyond what the osteoporosis is that produces kyphosis and hip fracture in older people. I think that unless an artificial gravity vehicle can be designed, that it's a hopeless proposition.
Thank you very much. That is absolutely a fine contribution. I am not surprised one bit that astronauts may not have been too cooperative, and I know that astronaut experience in space has sometimes been concealed. But the problem has been that we have had no experience with long-duration flight. All our flights, Apollo and the shuttle, have been short-duration flights. Until we began to take rides in the Soviet system. And then we began to have a longer experience and began to get a better insight into the Soviets' experience. They've had much more experience with longer duration than we have. And it is then, it is because of that, that these concerns have surfaced. The current administrator of NASA, O'Keefe, I think is to be congratulated for the first time that I've known an administrator speak up. He used language which I found very impressive. He said that there are very serious questions of the medical effects of long-duration flight, and that this must be a major new focus of NASA to get at. And this is what has led to the pressure to reduce the time to get to Mars from 9 months to a week or two. And that would be done with new propulsion systems, which gets you into nuclear propulsion. And tremendous problems which layer upon layer. I don't know how far they'll get with that.
Yes, Mr. Pryor.
You mentioned that NASA, the shuttle itself, doesn't meet its own 25-year-old specified goals. And without getting into that, you also indicated that it's a lot of new technology that had to be invented to make the shuttle fly in the first place. Is there any measure of the success for society, throughout society, on the peripheral knowledge that was gained in manufacturing, micromanufacturing, medicine, and other things like that? I guess you could call it trickle-down knowledge. How do you evaluate that part of the equation?
Well, very, very good question. From its early days, NASA has had specific programs at considerable expense to elicit precisely that kind of information from the space program, from the manufacturers and from NASA centers. And I think it was called the Space Utilization... Technology Utilization Program. Thank you. Yeah. I left NASA in 1979, and I'm a little rusty on some of these things. But in any case, a lot of material has been produced, but it was questioned. On closer examination, some of the examples cited of spin-off from industrial processes or NASA work and so on turned out, in some cases, they derived originally from industry in the first place and were used by NASA rather than the reverse. In some cases, they were totally valid, but the cost of application was enormous, and NASA simply wasn't accustomed to paying much attention to the cost, you see. For example, I remember one. It was shown that a new paint had been developed in the program. The paint was so good you could put it on a metal surface and then apply a blowtorch. The paint was unaffected, but the metal backing would melt away. So it was a marvelous new paint. The trouble is, it cost too much. Nobody could afford it. That, so, I mean, there was a lot of validity to it, and yet a lot of serious question. I don't know the present status of that program. I think it's gone through some hard times. But there was a valiant effort made that centers were set up around the country with industrial memberships. So people could, companies could attach themselves to these centers for a fee and have access to the new technology that was forthcoming. And there was a lot of material. But the question of measuring its ultimate application in industry, very elusive. I knew someone who participated in a Smithsonian study of transfer of some of these technologies, and as in, say, BART, the rapid transit system on the West Coast, and cryogenic technology, storing difficult liquids for transport on ships and so on. And the transfer of technology from one place to another was extraordinarily difficult, very difficult.
Yes.
Would you wait for the microphone, please?
I'm a physician. I've been involved in research space programs for the last 10 years and been publishing the last 10 years. And your talk is right on target. I believe, just the way you do, that we should go the robot way if we possibly can. In Apollo 15, James Irwin lost consciousness in transferring from the lunar module to the command module. He became very, very dehydrated because the in-flight water, the in-suit water device wasn't working, became very, very dehydrated. He was so short of breath during reentry that he couldn't speak at all during the 4 minutes of reentry. 21 months later, he had a heart attack. And so that it points up the fact that not only is there a problem with osteoporosis, but the risks of the blood vessels and both with the periphery and the heart are appreciable in space, probably because of primarily magnesium deficiency, which is lost with the loss of bone. So I agree with you 100%. I'd also like to add the Russians have made a tremendous contribution in the space program in many facets, and particularly in the cardiovascular system.
Thank you very much.
You had a question. Right here.
I think right here.
You talked about the medical issue, and I'm wondering if there's been any study done on the psychological impact on the different astronauts in space, or the impact of space on the brain and how it works.
I'm so sorry, I had trouble hearing you. Were you asking about the psychological impact on the astronauts?
The brain especially, and the brain especially.
I know nothing about that. I really don't. I can say that some astronauts return with the belief that they can answer any question on any subject. But not all, not all. That, I mean, I'm sure everybody has seen that phenomenon. And then, of course, there was an astronaut who insisted on an experiment in psychic communication from the space capsule to the ground. And I believe it was unsuccessful.
Arnold, one last question.
I just had an interest in the Washington mindset. We did not go forward with a supersonic transport by choice. The Concorde was a British-French endeavor, and then we did not go ahead with the superconducting colliding thing under the ground out in Texas. So what's the mindset that says a manned space flight vis-a-vis robots, what was the way to go? I mean, what led to that choice?
I'm so sorry. I sound so muffled. Can you tell me?
Well, let's say we did not proceed with a supersonic transport.
Oh yes. Okay.
And we nixed a hole in the ground in Texas where they were going to have a superconducting collider. So what's the mindset in Washington, I guess, in earlier years that said that manned spaceflight was the way to go?
Oh yes, that's interesting. I was at NASA when the British and French were beginning the work on the supersonic transport, and as head of the international program, I wondered whether some of our aeronautical people at NASA would be interested in participating. They were not interested, and I think that's the point. There was not an interest within the aeronautical community to participate in the supersonic transport because, as I remember the rationale, the British and French were pressing existing technology to the limit for the supersonic transport. You know, our current aluminum technology is being pressed to the limit, and so you could go no further. Our people felt that you should begin with entirely new technology that would leave you margin for later progress. And that was very expensive, and they were preoccupied with the manned flight program. So that was put aside. Now, it's of some interest, I think, that just last week, the British and French announced the termination of the Concorde program after 30 or 35 years, of losing money every single year. So it seems to me that under certain circumstances, people can cut their losses, but it does not seem a common strategy.
Could you, in conclusion, tell us anything that would help us understand a question mark that comes into everybody's mind, I imagine, who spent time in a bureaucracy? Were there voices which were raised in the bureaucracy opposing, even when you were there, and voices you've heard about since you left, which raised the kind of questions you're raising today? And if so, what happened?
And my experience is that there were always people in important places with visceral reactions against these programs. They were people who simply couldn't see the benefit or value of some of them. I mean, there were no arguments about communication satellites or surveys of Earth resources from satellites or surveillance satellites, which may have averted a Third World War. I mean, because surveillance satellites are what permitted the Soviets and ourselves to agree that arms control treaties would rest on independent national means of verification rather than inspection on the site. And so it was the surveillance satellites which permitted us to rely on that means of checking Russian compliance. So there were people who saw all that but had a visceral reaction against the manned flight. Now, in the Senate committee, I remember there were perhaps two senators who were very unenthusiastic about the program. One was Senator Mondale, but he was so nice about it, he never asked a question. He apparently was not, I would guess, he simply didn't want to do the work required to develop questioning, knowledgeable questions. He didn't like it, but he would put his arm around you and say, "I hope you young men are very successful." But he always voted against the program. Always voted against the program.
Well, and the other one?
Do you remember the maverick senator from
Mansfield?
Washington?
Senator Proxmire.
Proxmire, thank you, Wisconsin. Proxmire, that, thank you very much. Proxmire was very much against it, but he subsided into a sort of whimper. What he did each year was question the administrator's automobile, the expenditures for the administrator's automobile. And he did not pay attention to the major questions.
Well, we've had quite an introduction to the problem. We have vowed that we would close on time and have indeed been instructed to do that. So I'm afraid we're going to have to adjourn. But if anybody has the same kind of knowledge about another problem that our speaker has evinced here, why, please let us know.